It's Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. In this hour, True History. Later on, we'll hear a story of alcoholism starring James Cagney on the Cavalcade of America. Right now, it's You Are There from April 10th, 1949 on CBS, bringing us back to the 6th of April, 1909 for Peary's dash to the North Pole.
This is John Daly aboard the Peary polar exploring ship Roosevelt, frozen fast in the Arctic ice pack off Cape Sheridan, Grant Land, just about the northernmost reach of land in the Western Hemisphere. It is 1 hour before noon here, April 6, 1909, and we're going to make another attempt to establish radio contact with Commander Robert E. Peary. Commander Peary, Matt Henson, and their four Eskimo drivers were last heard from 6 days ago. Commander estimated his position then to be 130 miles south of 90 degrees north latitude. Unless unforeseen emergencies have arisen, the party should have covered that distance by now, and Commander Peary should be at or somewhere near his great goal, a goal no man has ever obtained before, the top of the Earth, the North Pole. If all has gone according to plan, Peary has been traveling approximately 25 miles a day. His last recorded position was 87 degrees, 47 minutes north latitude.
April 6, 1909. The polar exploring ship, Roosevelt. You are there.
The men aboard the Roosevelt wait as Commander Robert E. Peary, Matthew Henson, and four Eskimos dash across the frozen Arctic Sea toward the unconquered North Pole. CBS takes you back 40 years to the climactic hour of a great scientific adventure. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
When we last talked to the commander, he told us that he would not broadcast again until he had either reached the pole or had been forced to turn back. He said he hoped he would be talking to us again on April the 6th at 11 a.m. from the pole. Well, it is April the 6th. It's 11 a.m., so let's try and make that contact. This is the Roosevelt calling Commander Peary. This is the Roosevelt calling Commander Robert E. Peary. Come in, Commander Peary. Come in, Commander Peary. This is the Roosevelt calling Commander Peary. Come in. It may be that Commander Peary is trying to get through to us, but atmospheric conditions are preventing his signal from reaching the Roosevelt, or he may still be traveling toward the pole or back from it. We just don't know. But we're going to keep on trying to make that contact. Our circuits will remain open. Here aboard the Roosevelt, the original members of Peary's polar party are packed into this little radio room, listening eagerly, waiting word from their commander, word that will tell them that the great project they embarked upon 9 months ago has finally been successful. The original group of seven Americans. Besides Commander Peary, there are Matt Henson, the commander's constant companion during all his previous polar expeditions, the skipper of the Roosevelt, Captain Bob Bartlett, young George Borup, fresh from Yale, Dr. J.W. Goodsell, our surgeon, Donald McMillan, schoolteacher from Worcester, Massachusetts, and Ross Marvin, a veteran polar explorer. Bartlett, Borup, and Marvin are not aboard the Roosevelt at this time, but McMillan and Dr. Goodsell are here, and Dr. Goodsell is at the microphone right now. Well, Dr. Goodsell, are you at all worried about the fact that we haven't heard from the commander?
Not a bit. The commander's all right. He'll make the pole and he'll come back.
Well, why are you so confident, Doctor?
Well, anyone who's had the opportunity to work as closely with Peary as I have must have confidence in the man. The commander's an engineer. He has applied the scientific method to every phase of this expedition. Planning, and more planning. From the very moment we started 9 months ago in New York, the hand of Peary, the master engineer, was in evidence.
Well, you've spent many months up here, sir, but only now are you really making the dash for the pole.
Well, Peary knew the pole could be achieved only during the very short season between the 1st of March, approximately through the middle of April. So he brought the Roosevelt up last summer, wintered here. Spent the dark, dreary hours of the Arctic night, training the men for the job ahead, toughening us up. Teaching us how to build and how to use igloos, how to work the sled, work with the Eskimos, how to live with the Arctic. Men who came up green and soft in August were hardened Arctic hunters and explorers by February.
Well, I think you're a fine example of that, Doctor.
Now, I am indeed. All the men are physically in better shape now than they've ever been. Why, Perry's planning has been so complete, so detailed, that he even has recreation.
Excuse me, Dr. Goodfellow. Something is coming through on our receiver. The signal is not very clear. It's Captain Bartlett's frequency, and it must be he. Go ahead, Captain Bob. Where are you, sir? Yes, Captain Bartlett, we hear you. Where are you, sir?
Mark Perry, have you heard from the commander?
What's that? Will you repeat that, please?
Have you heard from Perry? What about the commander? Have you had any word from Perry?
Not yet, Captain Bartlett. Not yet. But where are you, and how are you?
Fight, bully. I'm at Cap 16, on my way back to the ship.
Well, when did you see Commander Perry last?
What's that? I don't get you.
I say, when did you leave Commander Perry?
Oh, 6 days ago.
How was he?
Shipshape, fine.
How is the weather where you are?
It's too blasted good. Too good. The ice is breaking up. Lots of open water all around.
Well, did you get any farther north than 8747?
Yes. I took a little stroll up the avenue. I got to about 88 degrees north.
Well, congratulations, Captain Bob. That's a great record.
Not as great as Perry's going to be. The commander's probably hanging out his wash on the pole right now.
Well, were you disappointed in having to turn back after you got so near the pole, Captain Bob? Did you know, for instance, that the commander intended to take Matt Henson with him on the final lap instead of you?
Well, I was kind of disappointed. But that was part of the Perry plan. Henson's a good man. None better for Arctic work. He's as good a sled handler as any Eskimo and better than most. He's always gone along with the commander. So it's right that he should be in on the finish. How are things aboard me ship?
Oh, everything's fine here, Captain Bob.
Thank God he'd better be. You tell that crew of mine that the brass better be shining and the woodwork sparkling when I hit the deck, or by all that's holy, I'll strip off their blubber and feed it to me dog.
Okay. I'll tell him, Captain.
I'm dog tired now, and Commander may be trying to get through to you, so I'll sign off. I'll see you all again in one of three places, heaven, hell, or the Roosevelt.
Okay, good luck, Captain Bob. Our channel will remain open. If Commander Perry starts calling, we'll hear him. The Perry plan Captain Bartlett mentioned is probably the most important feature of this expedition and possibly the greatest innovation ever introduced into Arctic exploration. The Perry plan is a carefully worked out system of relays which has as its main objective the getting of the commander to a point as close to the pole as possible, as fresh as possible, and with adequate supplies and equipment. And here's how it works. With the first break of spring twilight on February 22nd last, the entire party left the ship and proceeded by dog sled to the takeoff point at Cape Columbia, 90 miles west and north of this point. Captain Bob Bartlett, with his sleds and Eskimos, was the first to hit the polar sea on the dash northward. He cut a trail through the tortured, jagged pressure ridges that are formed when the gigantic 2,000-mile ice pack is crushed against the shoreline by the winds and the currents. And as he, Captain Bob, pushed out, he set up a series of igloo camps. Perry and the others followed in his trail, Perry always in the rear, conserving his energy, keeping himself fit and rested. Approximately every 5 days, a division of the main party, led by one of the Americans, would peel off from the main body and return to the ship, taking with them the most exhausted dogs and the least dependable Eskimos. Well, thus you can get the picture of the party gradually thinning out as its spearhead approached the pole. And finally, 6 days ago, at Camp 22, only 130 miles south of the pole, Captain Bartlett and the last supporting party peeled off, and Perry, Matt Henson, and four Eskimos began the last lap of this great adventure. In addition to Bartlett, Russ Marvin is still out there headed back for the ship. We haven't heard from him in quite a while. Another leader of a supporting party is young George Forrest. He returned to land a few days ago, but instead of coming directly to the ship, he went off to the east to put down caches of supplies just in case some of the supporting parties may be forced to cut over that way on their return trip. George Borup is only 21, a Yale graduate and a well-known athlete in his college days. He's affectionately called the Kid by the men of the party, and he's ready now to report by shortwave on how he's getting along so many miles away from old Eli. Come in, George Borup. This is the Roosevelt calling George Borup.
Hello there. Oh. Oh. How are things aboard the ship? How are you Kablunuk making out?
Kablunuk?
What's the matter? Don't you know you're Eskimo yet? Kablunuk means white man.
Oh, yes. Well, we're fine, George. But how's the weather out where you are?
Ah, no, Ray, Dolly, Swat, Dooley, Dooley.
Well, that sounds like some more of that Eskimo. What does it mean?
Ah, no, Ray, Dolly, Swat, Dooley, Dooley. If you want a literal translation from pure spit-out Eskimo, it means it's blowing like home, get out all of the time. Gee whiz, there's more wind out here than you'd find at a suffragette convention.
Well, how are you holding up under it, George?
My feet are frostbitten and blistered. It's a good thing I've only got two to worry about. Just think if I were a centipede, gee whiz.
Well, what are you doing for that frostbite? You better look after it.
I'm being attended by a famous Eskimo specialist on frostbite, Avatingwa. Right now, he's giving me his extra number one special treatment.
And what's that?
Well, he's got my feet tucked under his coletar, right on his bare belly. There's no better way to treat frostbite. Matter of fact, I'm beginning to feel a sting now. So I guess they'll be okay.
Well, we hope so, George. By the way, have you any word from Marvin?
No. I thought he'd be aboard ship by now.
No, he's not here. I understand that he left the main party only a day after you did. I thought you might have caught up with him.
No, I didn't. But don't worry about good old Marvin. He can take care of himself.
Here on the foredeck of the Roosevelt are a community of Smith Sound Eskimos. 29 men, women, and children have been keeping house for the last 7 months. Most of us had preconceived ideas about Eskimos. All Eskimos, so said the book, are a crude, primitive people, lazy, immoral, not to be trusted. They lie, they cheat, and they're dirty. Well, at least one part of that's true. They are primitive people. They have no written language, no school, no government, no kings, queens, or chiefs, no idea of what money is, nor property. But 7 months of living with these Eskimos, living as close as one has to live aboard this little ship that's no bigger than an ocean-going tug, 7 months of close contact have shown us that these Smith Sound Eskimos are honest. They don't lie. They're loyal, intelligent, and in fact, wonderful companions. They're not lazy. Their men are almost constantly out hunting. The women work 10 and 12 hours at a stretch. Incidentally, they've made every stitch of the clothing worn by the members of the Polar Party. And they're a gay, happy people, always ready to laugh with you or at you, as the case may be. I think the story that they can't be trusted is exploded forever on the basis of their work with this expedition. These Eskimos love Commander. A member of the crew has just fired two dog teams coming in at a very fast clip. They're about a quarter of a mile away as I make it, just rounding a towering Kohlberg out there and making directly for the ship. The dogs are straining at the traces. I can't quite make out who the men are, but most probably it's Ross Marvin and the two Eskimos, Kudluktu and Harrigan. Harrigan, of course, is a nickname. A member of the crew taught him the hit tune from George M. Corral's musical comedy, 50 Miles from Boston, and the Eskimo keeps singing it all the time. He hasn't the faintest idea of what the words mean, but he keeps bawling it all day long, you know. H-A-R-R-I-G-A-N spells Harrigan. As the crew of the Roosevelt has come pouring out of the deckhouse, they're all at the rails now, waving, greeting the oncoming teams. And Donald McLuhan has also come out. He's right here at the rail with me now. Mac is an old friend of Ross Marvin's, and I guess he's mighty glad to see him coming back, aren't you, Mac?
There's something wrong.
Wrong?
I see only two men, the two Eskimo. I don't see Marvin. Are those Huskies on, whooping and hollering the way they usually are when they come back to ship?
McMillan is going over to the gangplank that leads from the deck to the ice. He's going out towards the oncoming threads, which have almost reached the ship's side now, and I'm going to follow him with this microphone. The gangway is pretty slippery after watching steps going down. But Hooktoo and Harrigan are bringing their dogs to a halt. Everybody's running up to them. McMillan, the Eskimos, the crew members surrounding them, shouting questions. And Kudluktu and Harrigan have come off the sledges. They've knocked down on their knees in the snow. They're crying. Tears are flowing from their eyes. Wait a minute. McMillan is questioning.
Enough! Kudluktu, Harrigan, where's Marvin?
Babine, Dorchabok, Sikuliame, Dushamangilog.
No. Mac, what's happened to Marvin?
He bucks what was. He pietrisok. You clear, Pukut. You clear.
Oh, my God.
Mac, translate. What's he saying?
Marvin's dead. Drowned.
Where? How did it happen?
Kanuk. Kanuk.
He bucks what was. Kanaklapuk. Algereput. Dagureput. Kuritakhsiani. Dagabal.
It was at the big lead. Ross evidently tried to cross on soft ice. He was out ahead of them, and when they got to the lead, all they saw was the back of his coat floating in the water. Tom, you'd better get these two below deck. Let them eat and rest. We'll find out more when they're not too worked up.
Come along. Got to get something to eat.
Go ahead, Harrigan. Go with it. It's difficult to express what this means to all of us. Ross Marvin was one of the real dynamos of the party. Tireless, experienced Arctic explorer, a scientist to his fingertips, a gentleman, a wonderful comrade. The tragedy occurred at the Big Lead, a very wide stretch of open water, about 100 miles to the north. It was here that Peary and his men were held up for four long days on their dash toward the pole. But it did finally freeze over, and the party were able to get across. However, the new ice, as might be expected, was thin and treacherous, and on the way back, Marvin must have misjudged the thickness of the ice and decided it was safe to cross. These leads, these fissures in the polar sea, are the greatest hazards in all Arctic exploration. You never know.
This Peary calling the Roosevelt.
This is John Daly in the radio room of the Roosevelt. We've interrupted that camera because Commander Peary is calling in.
This is Peary calling the Roosevelt.
Yes, Commander Peary. Yes, we can hear you. This is the Roosevelt. We hear you, Commander Peary.
Yes, hello.
Are you at the pole, Commander? Are you at the pole?
I don't know. We have just set up our camp. I am going to take my observations now.
Well, do you think you've made it, Commander? Do you think you've reached the pole?
I can't say, but we will know as soon as I have computed my position.
How is Matt? How are the others?
Fine. Here is Matt now. Hello. Hello, Roosevelt.
Hello, Matt. How do you feel?
It is a fiddle.
Well, what do you think, Matt? Are you at the pole?
Why, dead reckoning. I'd say we've averaged close to 25 miles a day since Captain Bob left us. That should put us close.
What's the commander doing now, Matt?
He's shooting the sun down behind a little snow windbreak we built. Flat on his stomach.
How does he look?
He's very thin. Very tired. I don't think he's slept for 1 hour during this past week.
Well, is he excited?
It's hard to tell about the commander. He never shows his feelings.
Well, how about you? What are you thinking about, Matt?
Hour of triumph. Matt,
yes, sir.
I just What time? 11 hours, 30 minutes. What fast? On 60th meridian, mean time, 10 minutes. 60th meridian, mean time, 11 hours, 10 minutes. Greenwich mean time, 15 hours, 10 minutes. Got that, Matt? Yes. All right. Let me have the papers. Here you are, sir.
What's happening, Matt?
The commander's going into the igloo we built. The tables and charts are there. He'll be able to work out our latitude in a couple of minutes.
Fine. Look, Matt. What's it like up there? Describe the place for us.
I'm not much at doing this describing, but let's see. First off, of course, there's nothing to see but ice. Just ice. Nothing but ice. It isn't piled up in pressure ridges, not like it is near land, but it's not smooth either. It's jumbled up in spots. Lumpy and mean looking. We took a sounding before, and the ice pack is about 8 feet thick here. Right there, about 8 or 9 inches of snow.
No sign of life anywhere, I suppose.
No, nothing. But just 2 days ago, we did see some fox prints. Don't know why any wise old fox would want to come out here. Wait now. The commander's coming out of the igloo. He's making his reading. He's carrying a little flag, the little silk American flag. The flag he's had with him on every expedition. He's got a long bamboo pole.
Hello, Roosevelt. Here's a message for you to send to my wife. Will you take it?
Yes, go ahead, Commander Perry. Go ahead.
My dear Joe, I start for home and you. Love to the kiddies. Signed my name and dated April 6, 1909. 90 degrees north latitude.
Perry has made it. Perry is at the pole. Quiet,
Matt.
Quiet. That's the commander. Quiet.
My dream and goal for 20 years. I've nailed the stars and stripes to the North Pole. Old Glory is whipping in the wind.
April 6, 1909. Commander Robert E. Perry stands at the North Pole.
And now here is Robert Louis Cheyenne.
We were very interested in finding out what the Peary family would think of our recreation of the Admiral's moment of triumph. So we asked Admiral Peary's daughter, Marie Anagito, to come here and tell us. Marie Anagito was born in Greenland. She was once known as the famous Snow Baby. Today she is Mrs. Edward Stafford of Washington, D.C., the president of the Society of Woman Geographers. Mrs. Stafford, what did you think of our broadcast?
Well, I'm so excited, I'm practically breathless. I feel as if I'd actually been on board the Roosevelt. But I have been tremendously impressed with the amount of research and the meticulous attention to accuracy that has gone into this broadcast. Of course, it was a little difficult on my part to adjust to the use of radio in my father's work, because Mother and I have always congratulated ourselves that during all the 20 years of Dad's expeditions, radio wasn't in existence.
Well, that's not very complimentary to radio.
Oh, well, Mr. Cheyenne, don't misunderstand me, please. I'm speaking only from the family point of view. When Dad came back and told us of his many narrow escapes, we could hardly listen to him, even when his presence proved that the story had a happy ending. And just think how ghastly it would have been if we had had radio to bring us a day-to-day account of the risks and hazards that were the usual routine of Dad's expeditions. From his point of view, of course, I can see that radio would have been wonderful in helping to direct his parties in the field.
You probably know, Mrs. Stafford, that many people think your father's expedition had no real significance.
Well, the fact remains that no man has done what my father did, walked to the pole on his own 2 feet. And Dad certainly proved that man's endurance and his ingenuity and his courage can overcome the forces of nature, even at their harshest.
And that, Mrs. Stafford, is the theme of today's broadcast. That's precisely why we did it.
And I'm certainly glad you did. And I feel very sure that those members of my father's polar party who are still living, Commander McMillan, Dr. Goodsell, Matt Henson, and, of course, Utah, Dad's faithful Eskimo companion, would want to join Mother and me in thanking CBS for recreating so accurately and so very dramatically this great American achievement.
Thank you very much for being with us, Mrs. Stafford.
Peary's Dash to the North Pole was another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne.
You Are There, on Tuned 2 yesterday from April 10th, 1949 on CBS. You're listening to an hour of true history on Tuned 2 yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to the Cavalcade of America with a story of alcoholism starring movie actor James Cagney. From the year that he turned down the leading part in the Jolson story, which ended up going to Larry Parks in 1946, he was actually not seen on the silver screen in that year, and this would mark his only radio appearance in the story Thirst Without End, a rare radio broadcast from NBC from April 29th, 1946.
James Cagney in Thirst Without End on the Cavalcade of America, sponsored by the DuPont Company, maker of better things for better living through chemistry.
There weren't enough drugs in the world to cure Bob's disease. Oh, it wasn't a disease of the body, not at first. It attacks the mind and then the home, the job, the children. And not only Bob, but thousands of Americans have it, an insidious lingering malady. Bob had it, but he recovered. It wasn't easy, though. Treating an alcoholic is a long, tough job, heartbreaking to wives and mothers like me. But it can be done, and many American homes can be saved. I know.
Ma? Ma?
Yes, Freddie.
I'm hungry, and it's pretty late.
We'll eat as soon as Dad gets home, dear.
He's not usually this late.
Well, he's probably busy.
I wonder if he... No, I don't mean that.
Don't mean what?
Nothing.
Freddie, don't ever say that again.
I didn't say it.
Don't even think it.
Hey, that's somebody at the front door.
Yes. Freddie, why don't you go upstairs and get ready for dinner? You'll have to wash.
But if that's Dad, I want to see him.
Dear, I told you to go upstairs.
Well, hello.
Hello, Bob.
Freddie.
Hiya, Dad.
Bob, you're all right. I mean, you'll want dinner, won't you?
Yeah, I'll want dinner, Elaine. I'm all right.
Oh, good. I'll have dinner on the table in a few minutes. Freddie, don't forget to wash up.
Well, I won't.
Well, what'd you do today, son?
Nothing much. It was raining most of the time.
Yeah, it was. That's right. Sorry, I didn't see you last night, but I got home late and had some work to do.
Sure. I know, Dad.
Freddie, I want to ask you a question.
What about?
Oh, well, it's just that for a couple of days now, you've been acting like a stranger. What's the matter?
Well, last Thursday, it was Father and Sunday at the Scout Club.
Yeah, well, oh, I should have remembered.
Oh, Mom said you were busy.
Yeah, that's right, sure.
All the other fellows had their dads there, except Johnny Ward.
Oh, where was his dad?
Oh, don't you remember? He got killed in France.
Oh, yes, that's right, yeah.
Johnny and I, well, we kind of sat together.
Look, Freddie, forget it, will you, huh? It won't happen again. The next time something like that comes up, I'll be on the spot, right with you.
Cross your heart?
Cross my heart and honest engine. That's the right thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. That's the thing to say.
Sure.
Why, Bob, I thought you liked that program.
Yeah, I like it, but not on.
Oh.
I'm sorry, honey. I'll turn it on again.
Oh, no. If it makes you nervous, leave it off.
Nervous? Oh, what makes you think I'm nervous?
Oh, it was just an expression, darling. I didn't mean anything by it.
Oh, look, if you want to say it, that you think I need a drink, go ahead and say it. Don't beat around the bush. Let's have it. I can't stand hints.
But, Bob, I didn't have anything like that in mind.
You did?
No, I didn't.
Well, you... Oh, I'm sorry. I know I've driven you nearly crazy. Well, I've done about the same thing to myself. I know what I am. I know what I'm doing to you and Freddie and to myself. But it's something I can't explain. If a guy makes a bad mistake in business, he remembers it and doesn't pull the same boner again. But this... Oh, it happens over and over and over.
Please, don't talk about it now.
When the war was on, I did the work of three men. I felt I needed a drink now and then to pep me up and get me going when I was dog tired. I depended on the drink doing that. Well, now the war's over. There's not enough work for me, but I still need that drink. Not one, but a dozen, 50. I don't like it any more than you do.
I know, dear, but you can try to help yourself.
Try? Sure, I'll try, but... Well, because I love you. Always will, Elaine.
Freddie. Freddie, what's the matter?
Dad came home.
Oh, well, where is he now?
Upstairs. He's sleeping. He was going to take me to the ball game, but well, he didn't show up. And now he'll
stop it. It's all right, dear.
I can't help him upstairs. Mom, I wish I never saw him that way. I wish...
Freddie.
I...
Stay here. Yes, Bob. I'm here.
Oh. It's dark, I hear.
Yes, it's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh. I don't remember coming up to bed.
Freddie helped you up.
Freddie helped me? What'd he say? Oh, no. Never mind.
Bob, do you want anything?
No, nothing. I'm sorry, Elaine. It just happened again. I was going to take him to the ball game. I had half an hour before I was to meet him, and... Well, it was just one drink again. The one that's always going to be the last.
Go back to sleep.
You can't, I don't even remember driving home. Except for one thing. Oh, no. It was a dream, I guess.
What was the dream?
I thought I had an accident.
Accident? Bob.
Oh, no, don't worry. It must have been a dream or a nightmare or something. Don't turn on that light.
Bob, you've got to remember. You've got to.
Quiet. Elaine, well, why are you saying it like that? Come on, tell me.
There was an accident, Bob, a hit-and-run accident. It was in the evening paper.
What are you talking about?
You weren't home until after 7, well after. It was dark.
Well, if you're going to say something, say it. What are you getting at?
The driver in that hit-and-run accident struck a little girl. It was... Where are you going?
Go take a look at the car.
All right, Mr. Corbin, start talking. You called me here.
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, Lieutenant Wright here. You're looking for a hit-and-run driver who hit a little girl about 7 o'clock last night.
Yes, we are.
I think I'm the man.
You think? Why don't you know?
I don't know, Elaine.
Bob, you've got to.
What's this all about? You get me here at 3 in the morning and then hem and haw around. Either you're the guy we want or you're not.
Well, telling you, I don't know. I was drunk.
Oh, I see. Where's your car?
In the garage.
Were you out at 7 o'clock?
Yes.
Remember anything?
Nothing.
Remember anything vaguely?
That's just it. I thought it was a dream that I had an accident. And then I looked at my car.
And what?
The right fender is dented.
The dent wasn't there before you took the car out?
No.
You sure of that, too, Mrs. Corbin?
Yes, I'm sure.
Corbin?
Yes?
You realize you're letting yourself in for something very serious.
I know, but I had
to... Okay, don't touch that car. Don't go near it.
What are you going to do?
Make tests. The little girl was hit just about fender height. Medical examination shows it might have been a fender.
How bad is it?
Plenty. If she gets well, if... She'll never walk without crutches.
that you?
Yeah, it's me.
Oh, anything new?
Yes, they questioned me again, but I can't tell them a thing, Elaine, not a thing. I'm out on bail.
Oh, darling, no.
Yes, no. Listen, you've got to listen. The bail they fixed was high. I had to take a mortgage on the house to meet it.
A mortgage on our house?
I couldn't help it. I'm booked on suspicion. Where's Freddy?
I haven't seen him for a while. I guess he's up in his room.
He knows about it, doesn't he?
It was in all the papers.
I wonder if he'd talk to me. I mean, maybe if I said a few things I've been wanting to say.
Why don't you go up and see?
Will. Freddy! Can I come in? Freddy! Freddy! Freddy!
Well, isn't he here, Bob?
No, I guess he... Oh, wait. Here's an envelope addressed to you.
To me?
Here.
It's Freddy's handwriting. Oh, no.
Let me have that. Dear Mom, everybody says Dad's the hit-and-run driver. Everybody says he'll go to jail. Now, all the kids will even say worse things about him than they did before. I don't want to hear those things. Not about my dad. So I'm going away. I love you and Dad, too. I love you and Dad, too.
Stay here all night, Jackie.
But it's awful dark, Freddy.
Ah, we got a fire. Why, my dad... Oh, I've stayed here overnight lots of times on camping trips.
Yeah, but it's awful dark.
Well, if you're afraid, you can go on, but I'm gonna stay.
Freddy!
Hey!
Freddy!
That sounds like your dad. Did Elaine out here?
Don't you ever say anything like that.
Freddy, where are you?
Right here, Dad.
Oh.
Well, I'm going home.
You got car fare, Jackie?
No, I...
Well, here, take this. Last car's leaving in about 10 minutes.
Thanks. So long.
So long.
How'd you know I'd be here?
Did you think I'd forget our old camping spot?
No, I guess not.
Well, come here, son. Freddy, you've got to believe me, and you've got to try to understand what I'm about to say. See, never before tonight did I realize what was happening to you.
To me?
Yes, to you and Mother.
Well, I don't care about me. It's what they say about you. Gosh, I want to be proud of you. I got a right to be that, haven't I?
Yes, you have. If you come home, I'll try to make you proud. Please come home, Freddy. Not for me alone, but for your mother.
All right. Sure, Dad. I didn't leave because I wanted to. It was just that I thought you didn't care anymore.
You are listening to James Cagney as Robert Colvin in Thirst Without End on the Cavalcade of America, sponsored by the DuPont Company. Maker of better things for better living through chemistry. As the second part of our story opens, Robert Corbin, fully aware of the tragic results of his excessive drinking, sits before the fireplace in his home, slumped in despair, while his wife Elaine sews in sympathetic silence.
Did Lieutenant Wright talk to you today, Bob?
Yeah. Test didn't prove a thing. It was raining that night. No tire tracks, no broken glass, nothing to prove anything one way or another.
Bob.
Huh?
I've been wanting to talk to you about something, but I didn't know where to begin.
Yeah?
Please don't be angry.
Well, why should I be?
I called Alcoholics Anonymous today.
You what?
Yes, I called them. I wanted them to help. And they will, Bob, they will, but you've got to see them.
You mean that you call them about me? To help me?
Yes, give them a chance.
Oh.
You don't know what you're talking about.
But they do, Bob. I know it. They'll help you.
Will they? Listen. I'll tell you what it's like to be me. You start out in the morning promising yourself no drinks, not even one. And then something happens. Your throat gets dry. You think people are looking at you, looking at your shaky hands. And you want to crawl into a hole and not face the world, but you know that's impossible. You've got to face it out. There's only one way to do it. Take a drink. So you get it. You drink it slowly. It feels terrible going down, but it feels good, too. There's no explaining it except that your nerves and your body are hungry for alcohol. You drink it in. Every fiber and nerve drinks it. But you don't stop at one, or two, or three, or a dozen. And pretty soon, numbers don't mean a thing. And you don't remember. And that's it, Elaine. That's what it is. And you think anyone can help? That Alcoholics Anonymous can help me?
Try, Bob. Just try for Freddie and me.
You're a stranger here, aren't you?
Yes, I am. My wife called, and this is the address, I mean...
Well, sure. This is our clubhouse. Open from noon till midnight.
Let's
sit down over here. Let me introduce myself.
You don't have to tell me your name.
That part about being anonymous? Why, that's only true as far as the public is concerned. My name's Palmer, Fred Palmer.
Well, my name's, Bob Corbin.
Oh, yes.
You too. You know about me.
Yes, I know what you're going through.
You?
Bob, 8 months ago, I was like you are now. I know the symptoms. Well, I can help you, and you can help me.
Help you? How?
You see, I won't feel I'm square with myself unless I help another fellow. Would you like me? Would you let me help you?
Look, right now, I want a drink, and want it bad. And if I don't get it, I'll go crazy. My hands are shaking, my throat's as dry as cotton, and... Oh, no, you couldn't help
me. Oh, now, wait a minute. My hand shook like that. My throat felt like dry cotton. But now look at me. Look at the rest of the people here. That's why we have this clubhouse, Bob. So they can come here and not be alone. You see, we know how strong the urge is to have a drink when you're alone. So, anytime we feel that way, we drop in here and talk. It helps, Bob. Helps plenty.
But I...
Try it, Bob. I did. Oh, and one thing more. Here. Here's a nickel.
A nickel? What for?
If you ever feel you're slipping, use this nickel to call me. Look, Bob. The thing to remember is, you just don't take a drink today. Tomorrow is another story.
But listen...
It's all right. Now, keep that nickel. Someone gave me a nickel like this, and it saved my life.
More tea, Dorothy?
No, thanks, Elaine. The reason I dropped in was to tell you... Elaine, you won't feel hurt if I talk to you about Bob.
No, why should I? He hasn't taken a drink for weeks.
I know. Greg and I were talking about it last night, and he said he'd be glad to defend Bob on the hit-and-run charge.
Oh, that's wonderful of both of you. Oh, that must be Freddie. He loves the doorbell. Excuse me, Dorothy.
Of course. I'll have to be going in a minute anyway.
Freddie, you know better than... Oh, Bob. Bob. How do you feel?
Terrible.
Bob, why did you do it? Why?
Oh, I was all right until I went to the hospital to see that kid. I've been going there every week, you know, bringing little things. I started home today, and I got to thinking about the whole thing. I called Lieutenant Wright, and he still got nothing but my statement.
And then?
Then I couldn't stand the uncertainty, Elaine. I felt that if I had one drink, one, it would... Help me hold my nerves together when I thought about that sweet little girl.
Bob, we're going to call Fred Palmer right now.
What for? The damage is done.
No, it's not. You didn't touch a drink for weeks.
But now you need him again. You've got to go to the clubhouse.
Bob, bear one thing in mind. You're not going to take a drink tonight.
Just give me one, will you? One. My head's coming apart.
No, Bob. One won't stop your thirst. One drink is too many. 1,000 are not enough.
What time is it?
9 o'clock.
That's what you said an hour ago.
Come on, Bob. Deal the cards.
Why don't you get that clock out of here? It's driving me nuts.
Take it easy, Bob.
Look, let me have one drink, will you? And I promise you, I'll come right back.
No drinks tonight, Bob.
What time is it?
It's 4:30. Getting light outside. You'll feel better when the sun comes up.
Feel better? You know the only thing that'll make me feel better.
It's all right now, Mrs. Corbin. You can come and get him. He's fallen asleep. Exhaustion. But he didn't have a drink.
Yes, just a moment.
Hello, Mrs. Corbin.
Oh, Lieutenant Wright, please come in.
Thanks. Your husband in?
Yes, upstairs.
Is he... Can I talk to him?
Oh, he hasn't taken a drink since he went to the hospital that day a week ago. But you... Is there anything wrong?
Elaine, who was that at the front?
Hello, Corbin.
Oh, hello, Lieutenant.
Well, Corbin, you've got a break. A man spotted your picture in the paper. Read the story. He hadn't seen it before. Came in to us and told us that you couldn't have been the hit-and-run driver because that dented fender of yours was the result of a little accident you had with him.
Then I did have an accident.
Well, yes and no. The man said his car wasn't damaged, and you were so roaring drunk he didn't stop to argue about it. So, you're in the clear.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Sure, sure. Of course, you've still got a drunk driving charge to face. But you can thank your lucky stars it wasn't what you were afraid of. Well, I guess I'll be going.
I'm not drinking anymore.
So your wife tells me. I think it's swell. Good luck.
Oh, Bob. I can't believe it.
Hey, Dad, I thought we were going fishing. There's a... What's the matter? Is anything wrong?
Oh, no, son, nothing at all. And I never will be again. Come on. Elaine, we're going to bring home a string of fish a yard long.
Well, in case you don't, I've ordered them from the market. Now, have a good time.
Yeah. Hey, there won't be any boats left.
We'll be back by 6, Elaine. Bye.
Goodbye. And so, Bob is fine now. The nights when he doesn't come home until late, Freddie and I don't worry, because we know he's working. Working hard. We know he's all right. That's why I'm thinking now about other women, wives or mothers who went or are going through what I did. They're wondering if their husbands or sons can have the faith, the patience and the willpower to do what Bob did. They can, and it's worth the fight. I can tell you because I know.
Jimmy, as you can tell, we'd all like to thank you and congratulate you on doing a swell job tonight.
Thanks, Gaines. That job was really worth doing.
It certainly was. By the way, be sure to listen next Monday, won't you, to our program. We have a wonderful story and a great star.
Well, give them to me one at a time. First, who's the star?
Miss Helen Hayes.
Just that's enough.
And she's going to play the part of Molly Brown, better known as the unsinkable Mrs. Brown, which is the title of the story.
The unsinkable Mrs. Brown. Sounds like good listening. All right, count me in.
That we will, Jimmy. And thanks again.
Thank you, and good night.
James Cagney's next starring vehicle will be Thorn Smith's comedy, The Stray Lamb, a William Cagney production.
The music for tonight's DuPont Cavalcade was composed and conducted by Robert Armbruster. A Cavalcade play was written by Henry Denker. With Mr. Cagney were B. Bennett Barrett as Elaine, Conrad Binion as Freddy, and Bill Johnstone as Palmer. Others in the cast included Tommy Bernard, Virginia Gregg, Will Wright, and George Sorrell. This is Tom W. Collins inviting you to listen next week when our broadcast will originate from New York City, starring Helen Hayes in The Unthinkable Mrs. Brown on The Cavalcade of America, brought to you by the DuPont Company of Wilmington, Delaware.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
The Cavalcade of America, on Tuned 2 yesterday from April 29th, 1946 on NBC. And that brings to a close this hour of True History on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.